Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Derek Shulman. Derek Shulman is former frontman of the progressive rock band Gentle Giant, and also a former record executive who signed Bon Jovi, Dream Theater, Cinderella, Nickelback, and many more. In addition to all that, Shulman is now an author. His new memoir, Giant Steps, My Improbable Journey from Stage Lights to Executive Heights, written with John Wiederhorn, comes out this fall. In this conversation, we discuss Shulman's career as a musician, as well as an executive, including his work with the band Cinderella and that group's frontman, Tom Kiefer. We also touch on Enough's Enough, Pantera, and more. That's Derek Shulman on Into Music, coming up now. I kind of wanted to start talking about sort of the latter part of the book. And I wanted to read what I think is the best line in here. Music directors know more about bands, scenes, and styles than anyone else at the station. And as somebody who programs a music show, I thought, oh, Mr. Shulman, you get me.
Well, I found that out the hard way and the easy way back in the day, effectively. Yeah, it's true. They have more of a clue of what's going on than generally anyone at the radio station, for the most part. That's what I found out back in those days. I don't know if it's the same way today, which I hope it is, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, and that was one of the things in the book that was also, you know, you talk about how as you get to know them, you can talk about the bands that you're working with, but you can also throw in like, hey, what about Rory Gallagher? Or what about this? And that kind of word of mouth thing.
No, that's correct. I mean, usually music directors have a clue about more than just what's on their, their priority list or their top 20 or whatever it is. They know what's going on and they enjoy music as opposed to just their what they're told by the consultant or their program director. So yeah. So if back in the day when I was involved in that part of the business, I could come and say, what about Rory Gallagher, as you said, or the Jam or whoever that was on the label.
And with that word of mouth, I think there's something else that you mentioned finding out, which was when you talk to bands, you find out who they like or who they're friends with. And in this case, this led to John Bon Jovi telling you about Cinderella.
Yeah, but to a degree, yeah. It was virtually at the same time as I was aware of the band, because it was literally in a day when the manager came to my office and played me a couple of songs. I think I said to John, are you familiar with this band? And he said, yeah, they're great. You should go see them. So it was almost like a crossover situation. But certainly John, yeah, he said, this guy, Tom Kiefer, the singer, he's got it. And I always found, believe it or not, that the best A&R ears come from other musicians. They really are. I mean, that at least musicians you have respect for, their ears and their feel. Yeah. Exactly that.
I am curious of what you thought of Cinderella when you first encountered them.
Well, actually, I told you about the story about the manager coming in to me with a couple of songs, and I said, "Do you have any more?" And I said, "Well, it just so happened I've got a CD of some more songs, and there were literally 200 songs on this. I'm not kidding." 200, and I actually went through them, and I'd say at least 100 were great. I mean, not just good, they were great, but they were basically the music Tom had done it himself. So I went to see the band at this club in Philadelphia, called the Trocadero. And Tom was like, he had it. He was playing guitar, and Eric, the bass player, they had it, but they had a couple of players who, for me, just didn't quite cut it. And I said to Larry, the manager, Larry Mazur, man, I think that could be great, but you know what? If you can work on him, let me us. I'm going to assign them to a de not a demo deal, a deal where you can finance it for a period of time. Get two new mobile players in, and let me see how they work. And he had to fire two of the guys, and they eventually got Jeff LaBar and et cetera. So they finally put the band together, and then I went to see them again, and they were spectacular. They were amazing. So I put them in the studio with Andy Johns, of all people, which is a story in itself. And I think the first album was Night Songs, I believe. Yeah, that came out, and it blew into the top five of the charts immediately. It was, and then the band went out to play on tour, I think with Bon Jovi and I think with other bands. And at that time, which is another interesting little sidebar, they had literally just got together because the two new members were still integrating themselves into the band. And they were okay. They weren't great. They were okay. And what I did to Tom, who I could speak openly to him. I love Tom Kiefer. He's such a great singer, a great guy, and a great front man. And I could be, I didn't have to guard my words, with him. And I said, Tom, I'm going to do something. I'm going to come along to some of the shows. I'm going to videotape them. And let's go back in the van, or the truck, and let's play them. And I'm going to ask you, would you pay $25 or $30 to see this band? And I did that. And he said, yeah, you're right. We should do some this, and we should do that, and we should do this. I said, yeah, Tommy, right. And he really got it. So he and the band became really amazing, ultimately, in a very short period of time, which is great. I mean, it's a great thing to have someone, at least believe in what I was saying, because he understood that I came from the music world, not the business world. So I knew about stagecraft, and I knew about having to present yourself, et cetera, et cetera. So that was, it was a lot of fun to work with Cinderella. I haven't talked about this at all, but it really was. They were great as well.
I asked that because 1989, I saw a bill that had Tangier, White Lion, and Cinderella. And I had the Cinderella records, and but live.
They kicked ass.
And last year, Tom came through Wichita with his band. And I said, I enjoyed that show so much. I'm going to go back and I'm going to see him again. And he'd lost nothing. I mean, he was terrific. And it also, I was also kind of like, I that hair metal thing that obviously Cinderella got lumped into. I also realized listening to the songs a couple of things, which is that I think he was a better songwriter maybe than he sometimes got credit for, and that it was, he was somebody who could have done, almost kind of like a Mad Dogs and Englishmen kind of thing if he had wanted to.
Yeah, he loved. I mean, he was certainly not hair metal. He loved the blues and Janis Joplin and Joe Cocker. I mean, that was his world. I mean, and the fact that we had it was during a period when MTV was the big marketing tool as well as radio. And they did glam up a bit. I mean, that's what they did. But they were really more of a blues rock band than a hair metal band, but for sure. But their albums were, I think they were, I still are. They're great, and the thing about Tom, who's still a great friend, is such a great guy, is that he would listen and not say, you're full of shit. But some of the artists, not too many I've worked with, but would say that to you. I was really happy working with those guys.
You'd been in bands, but when you're working with a band and you walk into a room, let's say, and you're meeting all of them for the first time or something, how quickly do you become aware of what the dynamics are within a particular group? That's actually the guy who's the real brains, or that's the real leader, that sort of thing.
How quickly? Immediately. Honestly, I guess that was the, I think, thankfully, the thing that I was able to bring to the dark side of the business, if you like, having been in a band or been in two bands. And that's one thing that no band could ever say to me was, you don't know what it's like to whatever it is, you know, to sleep on a bus, to you know, take a private jet, to not have any gigs or et cetera. I've done it all. So it wasn't as if they could say that to me. And in fact, you know, let me go back to Cinderella. In fact, there's a song called Nobody's Fool. I don't know if you're familiar with that song. So Tom wrote this song. He wrote the verse. And I said, Tom, there's no chorus. And he said, what do you mean? I said, Tom, here's what you know. And I actually wrote it with him. You know, I wrote the chorus. And to be honest with you, I stole the lick from Def Leppard's, Nothing But the Heartache, or whatever it's called. I said, here, put this chorus on here. And I kind of sat down with him, you know, as a musician, and took a guitar. And we worked on it together. And Nobody's Fool became a pretty big hit for them. But I was able to sit down, as I said, with a guitar, say, try this. You know, I wasn't a producer. I was just the guy at the record company. But I was able to do that. But to answer your question, immediately, I could spot who was the real leader. In fact, like AC/DC, for instance, Malcolm Young was the leader, not Angus. I mean, I could go through the various bands that I worked with, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. But Malcolm was the heart and soul of that band initially.
Well, I was curious about that too, because you kind of got into the AC/DC world, and that band is notoriously closed off. Do you think it was your musicianship that allowed them to bring you in?
Well, I was lucky in the fact that their brother, George, who was in the Easy Beats, you know, I was running at the time, of course, their brother George, they called and said, there's this guy, Derek Shulman. He said, don't worry, he's cool. He was in a band called Simon Dupree. So I got the thumbs up for being in my first band as a teenager, because we played a few shows with the Easy Beats. So they kind of warned to me, and they knew that I was not just a record company geek with a suit. You know, I could relate to them as musicians. And so they allowed me to come into the studio, which they'd never had done with anyone else, you know, prior to me, you know, being involved with them. And so I was really happy to, you know, they were going to be dropped, in fact. I think I mentioned that in the story in the book. And I traded AC/DC they were going to be dropped. And I said, no, you know, don't, because the deal was pretty high and the last two albums had done not very well. It was Stevie Nicks, of course. And I had inherited Stevie Nicks on ATCO. And I said to the guy who was running Atlantic at the time, Doug Morris, I will trade you, don't drop AC/DC. I will trade you Stevie Nicks for an AC/DC, because they should not be dropped. This is a band that deserves to come all the way back. And so that's how I got into their graces. And we went to Vancouver with Bruce Fairbairn and Bob Rock, and we made The Razor's Edge. And then, you know, we put out the band, put out the album with Thunderstruck as the first track, and they came all the way back. That's my story.
Yeah.
I'm sticking to it.
Yeah. And one of the things that I found really interesting that you touched upon is that sometimes you wind up working around music that isn't necessarily like, you wouldn't go home and listen to it, right? But you recognize the potential of it and can appreciate what's behind it, and therefore can get behind it, like at the label or in radio promotion or something.
Yeah, well, you have to, you know, you have to be the person that prioritizes the push for the label, you know. But generally, I would hope that I would prioritize something that had value and had authenticity. I mean, when, again, talking about ATCO, I signed Pantera. That was the band that I was kind of familiar with before I went over from Polygram to Echo. I heard power metal with Phil singing. It was a different singer before. And when their attorney came to me at ADCO, he showed me a four-track VHS video of Phil with some new songs. And including Cowboys from Hell and I thought, wow, this is spectacular. I sent an A&R guy down there because I was running a company, and he called me within a couple of songs and said, man, you were right. This band's got it. So I went the next week down to this club in Arlington, Texas. And being a head of a company, you okay, impress me, And within three songs, I was almost in the mosh pit. I knew they had it. There's this little word, IT, and they had it. I mean, Phil was just an incredible front man. Dime was just they were geniuses. They had everything that, they had everything that would make them as big as they were. But I knew at the time also that right at that point that MTV were playing different kinds of music. They would not play, this band, and also radio would be a tough call with this kind of stuff also. So having seen the band and been completely blown away and knew how quickly I became a fan, is that I decided to certainly sign the band, but put money behind them on to tour. So they made sure that they toured. And when they went out there, maybe 500 people would show up. But I knew that word of mouth out there would get around. And the next time they went to the next city, 5,000 people showed up. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened.
It is funny when you see, as you said it, that capital IT, because I had this experience earlier this year. I saw this band that I was an opening band, right? And by the end of their set, I said, okay, I don't care that I'm 52. I'm going to quit my job, move to Germany, and start this kind of band. Because you feel it, right? You feel that energy and all of that stuff.
Yeah, there is a certain, there is a certain that's not too many artists have, and if you find that band that has that, whatever that is, and again, you can't bottle it, you can't pretend what it, you can't make it up, and you can't bottle it, and you can't pretend what it is, but when they do have it, it is an authenticity, it is a leadership role, it is something which is theirs and not anyone else's. Then you're extremely lucky, and then that's where I would also always put my energies behind as a record executive on that side of the fence.
You also write about this moment where you feel positive about enough's enough, and you're told, okay, but I like this band that's, at number five better because they're selling.
Well, yeah, that was it. That was my introduction to the real corporate world, if you like. Yeah, that was a that wasn't what was it? That was a moment in time which I will never forget because I'd come in to run this company, ATCO Records. I had my staff. I signed some pretty good acts, and they were starting to work. And I signed this band, Enough's Enough. And it was really, I loved it. I loved that the album. I thought that the new thing was going to be a smash, the first track. And I sat down. I decided, or we decided, I'd sit down with the head of Atlantic, we were part of the same group, but I think there was a bit of jealousy or some kind of weirdness between us, and we wanted to make sure that we wanted to break bread and make peace, etc. So, I came in, we had lunch, and this guy, Doug Morris, who was running the company, asked me, what's your favorite band you have on your label right now? And I told him, I think I've signed this band, Enough's Enough. They got this new track called A New Thing, and it seems to be blowing up. And I think they're fucking great. Unfortunately, they self-destructed. We'll get into that later if you want. Nevertheless, I loved what I was hearing, and I loved the band. And he said, "Yeah, I've heard some good things about them." And I said, "So, Doug, tell me what's your favorite band on that you have out there?" And he said, "Well, let me show you what my favorite band is." I said, "What do you mean, show me?" And he brought out a sheet, a spreadsheet of the sales. And he put his hand over the bands and he went down the list and he said, "That one." And he took his finger off. And it was the biggest seller. And that's when my heart sunk from my chest to my boots. I knew that it wasn't the record business, it was the business of records. And I thought, "Oh God, okay, what have I got myself into?" But I learned.
Well, and Enough's Enough is this case too, where it's like, even now, they'll put out records, and I think, I'm like, why isn't this the band that I'm going to see at the big arena? You know? It's kind of sad in a way, because it's also this thing of like, you can have talent in spades, but if you don't.
They did. I mean, they absolutely had talent in space. Unfortunately, they also had a talent for other things. And that was something I didn't know about and would have stopped in its tracks had I known a little more about it. But yeah, they self-destructed by using too much chemical substances, and that was such a shame because they had everything. They actually had it. But they lost it because of taking too many drugs. And that was such a shame because they should have and could have been, as big as other bands from that era. Listen, you can only live your own life, but if I'd have known, would have known that they had the propensity to do what they were doing, I would have tried to stop it in its tracks. Unfortunately, I couldn't. And so that it kind of went away and they became just another band, which is sad.
You also mentioned this thing toward kind of, in the wake of Nickelback, that sometimes there was a tendency to go after Nickelback too on the part of some people. And this idea of like, you want to sign bands, but you want to sign bands that are different enough,
Yeah.
In your case, Jethro Tull and Gentle Giant, both progressive rock bands, but you both have your own lanes.
Absolutely, yeah. So you mentioned towards the end of when I was running Roadrunner, I was involved in having Nickelback and signing them, and again they the band okay they had incredible songwriting chops, just just ridiculous song. And when I heard the first album, oh boy, what was the track? I can't remember. I'm blanking, sorry, I'm a little tired. But anyway, I heard the and it came, and it was a song that whenever I had a spare moment, I keep putting on. And I said, "Man, that's fucking great. I mean, what is, So I went to the A&R guy who brought it in, Ron Berman, and said, "This band Nickelback you brought in, with the, well, what's the deal?" He said, "Well, they recorded an album in Vancouver, no one wants it, et cetera, et cetera." And I said, "Wow." I mean, so I kept playing that track, and I played a couple of other tracks. But that track really hurt. I thought, this whoever this this songwriter is, this Chad Kroeger, is great. So I went up to Vancouver to see them, and they were really good. I mean, they were I wouldn't say amazing live, but they were really good. But Chad had some amazing songs, just ridiculous songs. And they weren't even able to get a deal in Canada, and they recorded that this album called the what was the one, the Stand, I think it is. Yep. And so I did the deal. It was a cheap deal, but I played this track to my head of promotion, and he said, "This could be a smash." So again, he went to a music directors, and he got it on the radio, and it became a top 10 hit. I wish I'm blanking on the damn song. I'll remember it in a minute. Anyway, they got their legs, get they got their sea legs together and became really great live. And then they got together to do Silver Side Up. And I remember hearing How You Remind Me as the lead track. And when I heard that, it was like, okay, I know this is going to be a gigantic hit for them and for the label. And it was. And it was the end of the beginning and the beginning of the end of Roadrunner, to be honest with you, because it blew the company into a huge next level of being a major independent label. And the owner, Pace Vessels, great guy, but unfortunately didn't quite understand that a band, you get these kind of things every 5 years. It's not every day or every week. And if you're lucky enough to get a band with it, then you touch wood and pray if you're religious. So he started looking for other bands that have similarities sonically, and no, you don't do that, because then you're not authentic, then you're not a leader, then you start throwing money after money, and that's what happened to the label, and that was the end for me as well, because I couldn't be a part of that situation where I was, chasing things that didn't mean anything to me.
There is something you write about early on in the book, devastating, the loss of your father. But in a way, I suppose there was this gift within the family, which was the music. And I wonder if you feel like the fact that you and your brothers had, and your sister even, had music, that was this kind of balm, if you will, that could kind of help heal.
Yes, of course. That's music was in my life from the day I was born, and I was very fortunate. I mean, it was awful to lose my father literally in my arms, and that traumatized me for the rest of my life. However, what he left for his kids was the gift of music, and that's something that, I thank whoever's up there that I've had that and enjoyed having music in my life my whole life, as I have my siblings too. So it's something that you don't learn. It's a part of your DNA, and I think we all have it. And my brother Ray, who passed away a couple of years ago, unfortunately, it was a creative genius, really. I mean, he played violin as well as bass guitar, but he was training to be a violinist in the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. I learned how to play and read music, but instruments were around the house all the time, and musicians were around the house all the time. And that's something that, as a kid, you don't think about, but in retrospect, you look back and say, boy, I was really lucky, that I had music around 24/7, except when I was at school, of course.
And your son, right, is also in the business, yeah?
His daughter, both my kids are very much involved in a creative world, and they're both actually both very really good very good musicians, but they're now more involved in the visual arts, and but yeah, very much so. And I guess, DNA is not a bad thing. It's as long as it's used for a useful purpose, if you like.
The Gentle Giant is one of those bands that has the time stamp on it. 10 years. You call it a day with Civilian. And I'm sure you've heard this before, that I mean, I listen to Civilian and I go, man, within a year, this could have been on MTV or the radio. They could have been on a package tour with Def Leppard and somebody else. But it was just the right time. It was the right time to call it a day.
The fact that it didn't, we weren't, it was. I'm glad that it didn't happen, because I've seen too many bands try to relive their lives 30, 20, 30, 40 years later. And for me, I look, I'm myself, I feel. I'm uncomfortable with it. I'm uncomfortable with bands doing the hits that they did 30, 40 years ago, and reliving a lifestyle that was when they were younger. I understand it's great for the fans to see and hear, their heroes. But if I try to get into a 32 waist, but now people, wouldn't get past my thighs. So, just in that respect, I didn't want to be a parody of myself, and that was something that we stopped it when it was the right time, so that and didn't people but there was a lot of people that used to say, you guys should get back again and do a reunion. No, let's leave that chapter untouched, and hopefully it will live on. And whether people care or not, I don't know. But it was 10 years of amazingly productive and creative and wonderful experience to be in a band that I loved, and the people around me who were incredibly creative and to be popular as well in some ways.
I discovered Gentle Giant through Mike Keneally, who I believe you've encountered. And his saying that, I think he said, if I'm going to be a real musician, I need to spend a summer learning all the Gentle Giant guitar parts. And then
And
did
he did as well.
that.
Great player, he is.
But to discover that there was a finite number of albums, therefore a finite number of songs, and it wasn't I love Frank Zappa, but it wasn't something like Frank Zappa where you have to go through all these different eras and everything. It was like, okay, this is it, and you get to savor them because there's only this number.
A limited edition of Gentle Giant. So no, we stopped, and again, we would not want to be a parody of ourselves, and or be a tribute band. So that I thought, in certain ways, I think Civilian was a really good album, actually, and it's a shame that it didn't happen, but in retrospect, I'm glad that it didn't, because it may have taken us into a world which we would have been embarrassed about. And that's something I would have hated to feel in my old age.
Well, I'll close on this. Gentle Giant continues to find new audience, some of it no doubt coming through the intense sampling of it from the hip hop world. And some of it, I think, just one way or another, the people hearing the music and going, oh, I didn't know I needed this. It has to be incredible to think about something that started over 50 years ago is still
Well,
rippling.
yeah. Well, that's something that's something I'm really happy about, that a younger generation, a new generation, is finding out about what we did, and there's a you I use the word legacy that still lives on. And I think it's because, to be honest with you, and we discussed this earlier, that we never tried to do something, or never wanted to follow someone. We were doing something which was ours. And we didn't say, let's try and sound like this or try and sound like this. We were doing something that sounded like us. And I guess that's the essence of why I think bands that have that kind of authenticity, use that word again, lives on and still is meaningful even after God knows how many years. I mean, the Beatles is the best example of that. I mean, when you hear Bring, it's a hard day's night. You just know what it is. That lives on, and you can't. And no matter who is, having worked on the other side of the business, no matter who's on the other side of the business deciding what, where, and how, it's always the music and the musician that lives on.
You've been listening to a conversation with Derek Shulman. His book, Giant Steps: My Improbable Journey from Stage Lights to Executive Heights, is out December 2nd in the US and November 14th in the UK. Shulman also has select book-related appearances scheduled for the month of October, including an appearance at Prog Stock, New York. You can find out more about those and his new book, plus Gentle Giant itself, at gentlegiantband.com. You can learn more about this podcast at kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And it's always a great time to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.